both wages and working conditions improved. So we have this happy picture that improvements to working conditions do not always mean that firms are going to economize on wages, which is the worry, and in other circumstances has been found.
On the 24th of April, 2013, an 8-story ready-made garments or RMG factory named Rana Plaza collapsed, leading to the death of over 1,000 workers and injuring over 2,500 more. The Rana Plaza factories manufactured apparel for international brands including Benetton, Primark, Zara, and Walmart. The aftermath was an increase in international pressure for compliance of RMG factories regarding worker safety. One of the concerns that was raised was, could the increased compliance lead to a fall in workers' wages or employment in an already extortionist market? In this episode, we turn to Rachel Heath, an associate professor at the University of Washington, for an answer to this question. Welcome to Banglanomics, a podcast series to propagate economics research for the masses and students of economics with a focus on Bangladesh. So today we have Rachel Heath with us. I'm honored to have you here today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Adnan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we jump into the paper, though, I just wanted to ask you, what motivated you to pursue an academic career in economics in the first place?
Yeah, so kind of a confluence of several things. My father worked at a university when I was growing up. He wasn't a faculty member. He was an administrator, but of a demography center. So I kind of was aware of, you know, visiting social science researchers. And so I kind of, you know, was exposed that like research seemed cool and interesting. So I kind of had that seed planted. For economics, I liked math in undergrad, but I also liked travel and talking to people and, you know, figuring out how different people live in different parts of the world. And so it seemed like that intersection was development economics. You know, we can get quite mathy, but we also, you know, kind of also get immersed in the setting. So that was a really exciting intersection for me.
One of the primary research areas that you work on is on the RMG workers, especially in Bangladesh. And I was curious in terms of how you made that into one of your key focuses. What motivated you to get into that?
So one of my advisors in graduate school that your listeners probably know, Mushfiq Mubarak, who's also Bangladeshi and works a lot in Bangladesh, I had the opportunity to work on a project jointly with him. He was running a survey on consanguinity, that if your readers don't know, that the tendency to marry your cousin. And I wasn't involved in the research side of that, but he needed an RA on the ground for that project because you have to, you know, to collect the data for that project, you need to do a roster of all your cousins. And, you know, that seems straightforward, but, you know, where there's very big families, you know, it did kind of need some careful pilot testing and with the survey firm. So, you know, Mushfiq said like, oh, if you're kind of willing to go and kind of be the RA on this side of the project and, you know, that would help him out. He said, I'm, you know, very happy for you to put a module on this survey of it, you know, an area of research interest for you. You know, students coming out of Yale frequently do the intersection of labor and development. And so I was kind of, you know, I could tell there were all these interesting labor questions related to the RMG sector, but that people hadn't, you know, asked them yet. And, you know, there wasn't kind of much existing data available. And so it seemed like a good opportunity if you were going to be collecting data to, you know, kind of focus on this population. So I went to Mushfiq, my advisor, with this proposal, and he was at first, you know, rightfully skeptical. He said, I just don't even know if this is feasible, Rachel, but, you know, they work all the time. Like, when will you even find a time to survey them? And some of them live in dormitories. Probably enumerators wouldn't be allowed in. And, you know, these are all very reasonable kind of concerns. And so it made me do my kind of, you know, background work. So I kind of figured out a plan to survey workers at night and kind of what areas garment workers not live in dormitories. And I convinced them. And so, you know, we did this survey that was multifaceted and had that consanguinity model, but also had this garment worker module that resulted in the paper that Mushfig and I wrote that some of your readers might know. It's, you know, one of, it's my most highly cited paper on the kind of the effect of the garment industry on women's lives, on women's education and timing of marriage and childbirth. And that also really, that also led to my job market paper, which was on, you know, hiring through referrals in the garment industry. So, and then later much subsequent work as well. So it kind of, that data set did generate a lot of research ideas. And so, you know, that's how I got started. And then I don't think I ever anticipated that, you know, it's now 14 years later that from the time when I collected that data, that I would still be working in the garment sector. But like, there just keep being more and more interesting questions, including the paper we'll talk about today. Just as you get to know the industry, there's kind of more and more stuff to look at. So I've just kept going with it. And there, it's a fascinating industry.
That's good to know. And I'm glad that you followed through and you stuck with it, because some of your work has been very, very illuminating on the industry. And I'm so happy that we know these stuff right now. Onto the paper very quickly. And it recently came out in the Journal of Development Economics. It's titled "The Effects of International Scrutiny on Manufacturing Workers, Evidence from the Rana Plaza Collapse in Bangladesh." Some of our audience might not be familiar with the Rana Plaza incident, especially those who do not work on Bangladesh or our labor. So it would be really fantastic if you could give like a brief history lesson about the disaster that happened and the aftermath implications that followed, really.
Certainly, certainly. So yeah, so the Rana Plaza disaster was, it recently, there was the, I don't think you should call it an anniversary of a tragedy, but maybe that is the word for it. But you know, it was about just over 10 years ago. So it was April 2013. And the Rana Plaza was, it wasn't just one factory, it was, you know, a building that housed many factories. And it just collapsed into itself. Sometimes people that see the pictures of the aftermath say like, oh, was there an earthquake? I mean, there wasn't. It just, the building wasn't structurally sound. It was not supposed to have factories inside it. That's not what it was zoned for. So this was, you know, being used improperly. There are many tragic aspects to this incident, but one of those aspects was that the day before, workers could tell something was kind of going wrong. They, you know, they didn't feel safe. They could tell stuff was kind of moving and didn't feel right. But a lot of them did return to work the next day because they were worried about, you know, losing their job or losing income. And the next day it did collapse. And ultimately it killed over 1,000 workers and many more were hurt. And so it was, I mean, this makes it the worst disaster in the kind of in the garment sector in any country worldwide, and the worst industrial disaster in any industry since 1984. So its human scale was large and very tragic. Immediately after, there was some sense that the Western brands, and I should mention, this factory was very much involved in you know, selling to well-known Western brands. So for instance, JCPenney, some of their clothes already had the labels on them. And so, you know, these were kind of well-known Western brands that were sourcing to this factory. So immediately after, there was some sense that these Western brands might leave Bangladesh, that, you know, that this was such a tragedy, they didn't want to be part of sourcing in Bangladesh anymore. Some combination, the kind of NGOs and policymakers involved with the industry, really, they're high profile instances of them calling on the industry, you know, no, don't leave, you know, stay here and quote unquote, you know, help clean up the industry. And people also made the point that workers might also be hurt if the garment sector just went away, that a lot of people really depend on income from garment sector jobs. So ultimately, whether it's through altruism or because, you know, the brands decided that it made business sense to stay, very few brands did leave. And if you look at the data on, you know, garment exports from Bangladesh over time, you know, it's risen just so much in the past 40, 45 years, but there's no, you know, there's no downturn after 2013. They just kept going up. So, you know, the trend of kind of increasing exports continued. But that doesn't mean that retailers ignored what happened. So kind of one of the high profile things that came out of the aftermath was that there were two initiatives formed, the Accord and the Alliance. You know, among the things they did do were audits of factories. And there had been audits going on before, but a lot of times they were done by for-profit auditing companies that maybe mistakes were pointed out, but they didn't really have kind of bite, so to speak, as far as closing down factories. And so, these audits were, you know, done by independent inspectors, and they seemed like they were well done. And there was some kind of help for factories. So factories did have to do a lot of the investment themselves to rectify problems. One of my co-authors, not on this paper, but of another paper, Laura Boudreau, has written on the Alliance had a provision to, they were supposed to have worker safety committees. She had an experiment where she worked with factories to increase the frequency of their meeting, but often they were not very active. And she randomly kind of bolstered the safety committee. Our paper on Rana Plaza, we're also just thinking that an important mechanism is that brands are just, they know that, you know, they're being watched for sourcing in a country with this recent tragedy, and that, you know, they might just kind of make improvements because they don't want to acquire such a, a bad reputation.
Just very briefly in a line or two, mention what the main objective of the study is.
Our objective was just broadly to see what was the, you know, what was the impact of all this international scrutiny on the workers. I mean, certainly the intention was to help workers, and, you know, that's what we hope to find. But as economists, we're also very attuned to unintended negative consequences as well. So, for instance, you know, we wanted to check if firms were pushed to really improve working conditions, then did they make those improvements at the expense of workers' wages? And that doesn't mean it would be kind of welfare reducing for the workers, but that, you know, would be important to point out that the improvements to working conditions might be coming at the expense of wages. So we wanted to try to assess that empirically. To do so, we used several rounds of the labor force surveys. So we didn't collect this data. It's done by the Bangladesh Bureau of Statistics. It was suitable for our purpose, you know, namely that they have several rounds beforehand and afterwards. So you can kind of assess things in the industry before versus after. They had, you know, there's a sample of garment workers, but there's a large enough sample that we had a control group of manufacturing workers not in the garment industry. So we were able to estimate effects of Rana Plaza with this data. We used a triple difference. We could do this with a double difference, a difference in difference, comparing garment workers to non-garment workers before versus after Rana Plaza. So that might be kind of, that was our starting point idea. But ultimately, we added another difference because you might be concerned that so many things are happening in the garment industry. It's unique in Bangladesh. If something happens in the garment industry, it might not be entirely due to Rana Plaza. So we added this third difference, which was, are garment workers, do they have differential outcomes after Rana Plaza, particularly in districts that export? So that was the third difference. So, and if we find that, then we're going to attribute, you know, that as kind of a particular effect of Rana Plaza, since all this scrutiny was coming from abroad. So we had more in kind of econometrics language and an intent to treat effect of just being in an exporting area. And that's, you know, that's it's also, I think, policy relevant because we're estimating, you know, even if some of these retailers weren't directly impacting, they might have indirectly been prompted to respond because other factories around them were offering better working conditions and they had to as well. So, you know, we still think what we've estimated is interesting, even if we can't kind of identify exactly all of the driving forces.
What are the main findings that you find from the study? And I know that some of the main indicators were in terms of the wages and the working conditions, the average changes in work hours and the contracts. And I was also curious in terms of how you chose these particular outcomes. And is there any important heterogeneity that you'd want to talk about, maybe by gender or and by any other aspect?
So yeah, so how do we choose these outcomes? It was a combination of theory, you know, what does kind of economic theory predict might happen? Practicality, it needs to be in the data. And you know, also kind of what policymakers, journalists, qualitative observers were kind of raising as possibilities from what they observed. So we, you know, we started with working conditions because that was, you know, a lot of the direct focus was on, you know, make factories safer. But, you know, to kind of construct this measure of working conditions, we were constrained by what was in the data set. Everything we had, which is a mixture of safety is measured by, you know, lack of injuries, but also amenities like maternity leave, lack of harassment from management. We put all of these into an index to kind of say in aggregate, how do working conditions respond? And wages, of course, as I mentioned, you know, there's the concern that factories might economize on wages if they're spending more otherwise. And then we put the other two outcomes that represented our primary outcomes. We looked at contracts because we weren't sure if, you know, there was going to be an effect on job security or in this new environment where firms are spending more, but there's more scrutiny, something they could get in trouble. Is one of their responses that they are less likely to give workers a, you know, a commitment as far as a contract? Finally, as far as hours of work, there was some sense that factories were actually asking workers to work more overtime in the aftermath of Rana Plaza. If they lost any workers, not directly, but you know, if workers had quit or anything, that workers that stayed were facing additional pressure. So we looked at that as well. So our key findings were that both wages and working conditions improved. So we have this happy picture that improvements to working conditions do not always mean that firms are going to economize on wages, which is the worry. And in other circumstances has been found that if you require firms to, you know, to improve working conditions on some dimension, they do economize on wages. But we didn't find that here, which was a happy finding. And we didn't find very large effects on either contracts or hours of work.
Seems like things are moving at least in the right direction. And one of the other findings that made me happy was when you mentioned that less educated men and younger women seem to have benefited more. But I was also curious with that in terms of why do you think that happened? Why do you think these were the cohorts that were really benefiting more? Was it just a marginal effect?
We ultimately argued that our results are most consistent with a monopsony model. So monopsony means when a buyer has market power. And, you know, it is plausible that while there are a lot of garment factories in Bangladesh, there are even more workers. And so that some factories might have some degree of market power when they're hiring. And what that means, if a monopsony model does apply, is that firms can raise total compensation without going out of business. And that's what we argue we're finding, is that in a perfectly competitive market, firms are paying exactly what they can afford and, you know, if they any more and they'll go out of business, but that wasn't what applied here. And so that brings us back to the heterogeneity you mentioned, that, you know, younger women and less educated men. And, you know, the context of this monopsony model, there might be particularly large effect on workers that, you know, didn't have as good of an outside option beforehand, because, you know, firms kind of have particular market power over the workers that don't have good alternatives. It's plausible that, you know, the younger women, the less educated men are those types of workers.
If you were to give any one major policy suggestion to the policymakers of Bangladesh, what would it be?
If you focus on the policymakers from the point of view of Bangladesh, you know, it's a little tricky because the actors in our study are primarily the international actors. One kind of, I don't know if it's a full-fledged policy implication, but one just observation is that having all that international attention, it might be viewed as kind of making Bangladesh look bad or, you know, kind of a negative outcome, but it, you know, did help the workers. And so that's, I think that's something to keep in mind. If you kind of take a step back and say, you know, what it looks like we found is this monopsony model, a policy intervention when firms do have monopsony power is that the wage they set will be inefficiently low. This has implications for the minimum wage discussion, but to keep in mind that is really needed to potentially counteract any sort of market power on the part of firms.
Any advice that you'd like to share with budding economists who are planning to pursue a research career in economics, especially who are planning for grad schools or maybe just coming out of grad school and deciding what they want to do? What should they really focus on and how should they really approach?
You know, this kind of definitely takes me back to my undergraduate career. And I know sometimes people say that when you give advice, you just say what you did. So I'll kind of run the risk of doing that. But I do think kind of, you know, if you want to be an economist and especially a development economist, that you do really want to develop in parallel really strong quantitative skills. So take a bunch of math classes and econometrics and get those skills ready. They'll be, you know, important for graduate school admissions. But also, but again, especially if you're interested in development economics, see the world. When I was an undergraduate, My university had a study abroad program at the LSE, but when I, you know, went to the director of undergraduate studies who needed to approve the study abroad plans of all economics majors, even if they're not going to the economics program, I was going to go to Bolivia. And like, she had never heard of this program, the director of undergraduate studies. She said, why are you going there? Don't you know we have this great program at the LSE? And I said, I want to be a development economist. So, that was just a great program just to, you know, live in a low-income country. And I just went to the local university and, took classes with people there. And so I think that was, you know, a really formative experience for me.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Yeah.
Absolutely loved reading the paper, and I hope the audience and the students enjoyed the conversation as well. Thank you again for making time to be here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.